MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Welcome to a new edition of the Spy Talk podcast. We got a great guest today, a former Pakistani ambassador to the United States, Hussein Haqqani, who's going to be talking about, of course, the Iran war. And he is in Abu Dhabi, and he's very familiar with the players in the negotiations and the Gulf states and so on. So he's got a lot to say about that. Meanwhile, the story of the week in Washington, Latou Washington, is talking about, of course, the Kash Patel story about his alleged drunkenness and so on in the Atlantic magazine. There's been a lot of pushback on that story because of its use of anonymous sources. And I just want to point out to people who don't follow the mechanics of reporting, these aren't sources who are anonymous to the reporters and editors. These are people who the reporters and editors know. They know them all by name, and they have various degrees of trust in their information, but they cannot reveal their identities because they want or demand protection. Now, the story of Patel's alleged drunkenness, inability to function, and so on, that's been the talk of the town, but the New York Times kind of recycled their reporting on the FBI that they wrote back in January, in which they quoted many FBI, ex-FBI officials on the record, who talked about the destruction of the FBI under Kash Patel and for a while Dan Bongino. And it was really disturbing for our neck of the woods, the security aspect here. It reported that 25%, up to 25% of FBI agents have been detailed to work on immigration cases. This is on top of all the firings of the people involved in the January 6th cases. And a number of the former FBI people have raised red flags about whether this has hurt the national security of the United States. And here we are at war with Iran. I dare say that I hope it doesn't happen, but if there were an Iranian terrorist spectacular here, that heads would really roll in this administration, and rightfully so. So, Mike, what do you think about that? You've been covering FBI for decades.
Yeah, look, certainly, as you point out, there have been multiple well-sourced on-the-record accounts of how Patel has completely disrupted the work of the FBI, fired senior officials with years of experience because they somehow were involved in one way or another in investigations into Donald Trump.
We should just clarify, they were assigned to these investigations. These were not things they volunteered to do.
They were assigned to these investigations for the most part, yeah. Yeah. And look, these were investigations in which, you know, the search at Mar-a-Lago was approved by a federal judge. I mean, to then turn that into misconduct by the agents who pursued it seems a bit bizarre, at least. But, you know, you mentioned people being diverted to immigration cases. It's not just immigration cases. It's the cases that Trump wants brought against his political enemies that has also been a major focus of this Justice Department. And we had multiple developments over the past week. First, Joe DeGeneva, a U.S. attorney from the Reagan years, who was a fairly well-respected U.S. attorney, but since then has turned full MAGA and was part of Trump's 2020 election denial campaign, has been brought in as a senior counselor at the Justice Department to oversee these investigations into former CIA, ODNI, and other officials who worked under President Obama on the Russia collusion whatever, the intelligence assessment that concluded that Russia A, did interfere in the 2016 election, and B, did so in order to favor Donald Trump. That's been a burr in Trump's side for quite some time, and he's determined to get, he's going after John Brennan. A lot of developments on that. We'll see, but there's a feeling that these cases are coming to a head one way or another very soon. There were subpoenas issued in the District of Columbia for former CIA and ODNI people. They were withdrawn. Now they're going to be voluntary interviews. It's not clear what that's all about, but all signs are that the investigations are going forward.
Yeah, and it doesn't give us a lot of faith that these are conducted in good faith. I mean, to say the least. You mentioned the ODNI just briefly. You know, Tulsi Gabbard has been invisible on the Iran war issues, but she's been very busy in this arena of going after former Obama officials and so on, people involved in areas that Trump doesn't like the impeachment drive based on his pressure on Zelensky to come up with dirt on Biden. She, as we noted last week, she's referred a couple of people, the inspector general for the intelligence community and the whistleblower in that Ukraine case to the Justice Department for prosecution. But meanwhile...
Wait, can I just, but before we leave this, I just had one other point I wanted to make. When DeGeneva was appointed to the senior position to oversee these cases, Todd Blanche, who's now the acting attorney general with Pam Bondi's exit, Todd Blanche, the same Todd Blanche who was the personal lawyer for Donald Trump on these cases that were brought against him, posted on X a picture of himself, DeGeneva, and several other senior people in the Justice Department. And what he said was, "Welcome to the fight." Now, you know, back in the day, before pre-Trump, Justice Department prosecutors were supposed to be there to do justice and not view their role as part of a fight against others, some other political entity. So I think that gave an interesting insight into how they look at things in this Justice Department. Yeah. It's a fight. It's a war against their political enemies.
Meanwhile, fights. Karen, bring us up to date on the fight over renewal of this surveillance law, which, let's say, loosely libertarians have opposed because they see it as intrusive violations of Americans' private affairs.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. Every week we talk about this because it's sort of on a loop of how much can we delay this? How much you can stay in the middle of this conversation without getting any resolution? What the Trump administration wanted for this surveillance law that has been abused in the past and has a lot of loopholes that are there for abuse under Section 702, what they wanted was an 18-month extension so they could just push it off to the future. What's happened now is they got a 10-day extension before some kind of vote can take place on what's going to happen next. But I just want to point out that, you know, we have a surveillance law that in good times we're worried about. Now we have times where people are worried. Who's surveilling them? Who wants to know their private information? Who wants to know what they're saying to their friends? It's a way of scaring just people throughout. It's not just, you know, other public servants. It's not just people who are accused of crimes. It's really opening up the surveillance conversation in a way that people find very scary. And the right and the left seem to be having the same concerns over privacy. Who's going to collect the material? Who's going to look at it? What's going to be used for?
Let me ask you this, Karen. Is there a way to renew a law that, I mean, many moderates and even, you know, Biden administration officials think we need this surveillance law to keep track of terrorist threats, that this is not just some overreach like is being done with the FBI, for example, under Cash Patel, that this is really an important surveillance law. Is there a law that can be passed that would protect Americans' secure privacy and still get the bad guys?
Well, the way it's played out every single time this comes up for a discussion is a warrant requirement. that you collect what you collect. We know that you get things that you're the people that you weren't targeted overseas, that you're collecting Americans' information. But if you want to look at it, you need a warrant. You need
But they say, well, there's not enough time for a warrant. Oh. You know, we're listening to a conversation. We got to stay in this conversation to keep listening.
So you got to balance
it. Is there maybe a new law, or can this law be adjusted so that the government could more quickly get a warrant to continue listening to this conversation?
First of all, we don't really know that it really takes that long to get a warrant, right, in this particular circumstance. Second of all, we have the FISA court, which has been sort of a rubber stamp for whatever the government wants. So right now, you know, that's sort of an issue. All you have to do with a warrant requirement is to not misuse the warrant, you know, the warrant requirement, which is sort of what you're suggesting, that it'll be misused, it'll be delayed. No. Well, law enforcement knows how to respond to things at the local, state, and federal level of when they're a pressing circumstance. That's what judges are for. That's what they do. That's how we think it out. So I think that's just a false consideration and goes to the heart of they don't want to give up on this idea that they can surveil whoever they want, whenever they want, and collect the private information of Americans. And it's not okay.
And in this administration, we're worried about them overusing,
yes, more than
exploiting it to go after their political enemies.
So wait a second, Karen, they got a 10-day extension. When does that expire?
On the 30th. So we'll be having the same conversation next
week. Yeah, I'm saying, is this going to be like Trump's 2 to 3 weeks to the end of the war the ceasefire ends Tuesday? No, Wednesday. No, I'm extending
it. I'm so glad you brought that up because I've had that going through my mind. Like, is everything just a state of limbo now and we're just pretending we're making progress? Or are there ways we actually know how to make progress? And I don't know.
Okay, before we get on to Hussein Haqqani, I want to bring up one last thing here in our part of the world. The CIA agents were killed in an automobile crash in Mexico. The president of Mexico is pretty upset about it. She said, we have these standing arrangements with U.S. intelligence, but this was not on the books. And these guys should not have, they were operating outside of their authority in the Chihuahua state, which borders on Texas. So CIA has been involved in anti-drug operations in Mexico for a long time, and a long time they were secret. I reported on this back in the day, a decade at least ago, that they worked very closely with a Mexican naval unit to go after drug kingpins and so on. Very, very on the down low, very quiet. But now it's all public, and Trump has been pushing for more involvement of U.S. intelligence in Mexico going, and even he's talked about, well, he talks about a lot of things. He's talked about, you know, using U.S. military to, I don't know, fire missiles at drug kingpins and so on. So
Joe, we've been blowing up boats that are supposedly carrying drugs. So
why not just start dropping ICBMs on Mexico? Oh my God. Anyway, let's move on to the ongoing war. Mm-hmm. It's not going away. It seems to get more muddy by the moment. One person who's really well positioned to help us sort out all these issues is Hussein Haqqani, who's a former, you know, Pakistani ambassador to the United States, who you and I, Mike, at least know quite well over the years. But he's not only a former diplomat, he's also an intellectual. He's written several books about U.S.-Pakistani relations, Pakistani's role in South Asia and so on. He's really a well-informed and thoughtful person. So without further ado, let's bring him on. Hussein Haqqani, welcome to Spy Talk. Mr. Ambassador, why was Pakistan so eager to involve itself in the U.S.-Iran negotiations?
Well, there is, of course, the official explanation, which is that Pakistan is a neighbor of Iran. Pakistan has good relations with all the Arab Gulf countries. Pakistan sees itself as a critical country in the Islamic world, and it's the only country with nuclear weapons in the entire Muslim world. And it has the prestige that it can be deployed for talks involving a major Muslim country like Iran. And President Trump likes Pakistan's current leadership. So that made it just the right party to be able to do it. The other side to it is that Pakistan has faced a bit of international isolation since the discovery of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. The United States didn't like it. The Europeans were critical of it. India has a perennial problem with Pakistan, and the Middle Eastern countries also objected to some of Pakistan's policies. So this is a great opportunity to wash it all off and come across as the savior of the world.
A great opportunity to wash it all off. Yes, we want to get back to these questions of the implications of Pakistan's involvement and inching closer to President Trump, getting closer to his affections. I also wonder what the implications are for the Pakistan-India relations. Both nuclear powers, it hardly needs repeating, who have been at war with each other intermittently for 75 years. Do you think this will bolster Pakistan's militancy towards India?
Well, the head of Pakistan's military, who is now a field marshal, Field Marshal Asim Munir, probably hopes so. He would like to leverage Pakistan's newfound international status vis-a-vis India. That's what the Pakistan military has always wanted forever and ever. That's why they ever became friends with the United States. There are certain impediments to that, Jeff. And the problem is Pakistan is not doing that well economically. And when you don't have too much money, then it's not easy to be a major military power. Projecting power becomes limited. Second, even though President Trump praises them almost every other day in his Truth Social posts, he hasn't really given them anything. He hasn't reopened military funding, FMF. He hasn't put Pakistan on the very small list of countries that now receive American assistance. And there are a lot of things in the air. Things like crypto deals and critical minerals deals that people say involve some of the people close to the president. But I don't think any of them will materialize within the two and a half year framework of the Trump presidency. So the substantive benefits of all of this are not going to flow to Pakistan quick enough.
So, look, we've all experienced a whiplash over the last few weeks on negotiations on, off, ceasefire on, off. It looked like things were coming to a head this week. And, then at the last minute, the Iranians indicate they're not even going to show up, causing Vance to cancel his second trip to Pakistan. As a professional diplomat, give us your take on these negotiations and whether there is any reasonable prospect of them going anywhere.
Well, if there were reasonable negotiations and if there were diplomatic negotiations, then there would be prospects of them going forward. But what we see in Washington, D.C. is not reasonableness, and it's certainly not diplomacy. Diplomacy sometimes involves passing messages and then waiting to hear back. You don't always immediately announce that I have said this and I am sure that this is going to be accepted. The Iranians have a sense of history. The Trump administration does not. I don't know if you remember Jared Kushner's comments in the New York Times when he described himself and Witkoff as deal guys. We are deal guys who are different from historians and diplomats because all we care about is the deal and therefore we get it. Well, the Iranians don't. It takes two to have a deal. The Iranians pay more attention to history. And from their point of view, there's bad history between the United States and Iran. And so the U.S. has an obligation to show them good faith. Also, they've shown from their perspective that in the last several days that they're not easily intimidated. They'll take the loss, they'll take the beating. That's their history as well. As long as they're standing or they're surviving, they've won. And so Trump's desire to proclaim victory has been the impediment to a conclusion, a positive conclusion to the negotiation. Otherwise, look, there are three elements. One, Iran's nuclear program. Almost everyone, including Iranians, would agree that Iran has to give something on that. Sanctions and anti-Iranian sort of actions of the United States. And everybody agrees that America will have to make some concessions on that. And then there's the question of the Strait of Hormuz, which was fine and open until this whole chapter started. There, all the Gulf states and the United States and the international community wants Iran to make concessions. And Trump is probably willing to split the difference. He likes the idea of tolls being collected there, which he can then share. Will it happen? I'm not too sure. But those are the negotiating points. I think the professional negotiators have made progress, according to my information from Pakistani sources in particular. But each time they make some progress, there is a negotiation shattering Truth Social post. If what President Trump thinks is a deal is what Iranians think is a instrument of surrender, it won't happen. The Iranians are not going to surrender.
When you say that your sources tell you that they have made progress, can you flesh that out at all? I mean, like, what have they made progress specifically on? And then where do things go from here? I mean, that's...
Well, I think the Iranians have been willing to consider various limitations on their nuclear program. They want to continue a civilian program, but are willing to accept all kinds of restrictions on the potential military deployment of that program. Now, will that satisfy Israel? Will that satisfy the United States? There, you will need a lot of details. Who will?
That sounds a lot like the deal that Obama got with the...
Exactly, and the deal that President Trump did not like. So here's the problem. Look, the deal with the JCPOA with the Obama administration was in 2015, and it put off Iran's nuclear weapons program or Iran's nuclear enrichment program for 15 years. It would end in 2030 if it hadn't been canceled. So the Iranians say, okay, now if you do add another 10 years to that, you've deprived us of nuclear enrichment for 25 years. The Trump administration wants to have in number, you know, President Trump is big on numbers. So he wants to be able to say, Obama got only 15 years, I got 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 or 200 or 900. Yeah. So he wants to be able to say that. And that doesn't sit well with the technical aspects of the negotiation, because the Iranians argue, what if new technologies emerge through which enriched uranium can be used for cancer treatments, this, that, etc. So it's an ongoing argument, by the way. That's the reason why the 15-year agreement was had taken place. Secondly, we must remember, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it can very easily be brought under some discipline there. The question is, can you trust it? And the response of the Iranians to that is, yeah, but can we trust the United States? Since 1971, since we've had the revolution, the Americans have never liked our very existence. And so if they don't like our existence, they've done everything. They supported in the beginning, if you remember, soon after the revolution, there were all kinds of attempts. Even before the hostages were taken, there were coup attempts. There were attempts to try and buy over the then president, if you remember, Bani Sadr, who then ended up in Paris, etc. So it's a very interesting thing. Somebody told me that when the Iranians start the conversation, their talking points take it all the way back at least to 1953, if not to 500 BC. The Americans are not interested in any of that, especially the deal guys. All there is, okay, now we'll give you $2 billion. Two and a half, three. And they're not interested in talking money that way. And so that has been a bit of a difficult thing. But on the nuclear question, I think there has been some understanding on the Iranian side that they will have to accept some limitations, some restrictions, how they will be put in place, who will help implement them, how will there be sufficient global confidence in it, especially of those who are worried about it, the Arab countries and Israel. Those are questions that remain to be resolved. But more than any of that, Michael, this is about trust. And I don't think either side trusts the other. But both also want an out. The Iranians don't want more destruction. They don't want more people killed. They don't want more of their infrastructure destroyed. The country is not in a good shape anyway, so they don't want that. And I don't think President Trump wants the disruption to the global economy that all of this has caused, plus the reputational damage he has had with the Republican base, which wanted him never to get into a war in the Middle East.
I want to come back to the role of Pakistan and sort of how, because I think you laid out beautifully the differences, not just in terms of the specifics here, but the time frame. And this has been a problem with the United States negotiating internationally in the Middle East and beyond for a long time. You know, the short term versus the long term, how you understand the historical backdrop. What I want to understand about Pakistan, as you said, Pakistan doesn't seem to be getting the kind of incentives that the Trump administration might have promised, that they thought they might have gotten financially, economic, and otherwise. My question about Pakistan is, what can they do, given the fact that they're between distrustful, two countries that distrust each other, that are speaking a different language in terms of time frame, that are not, they're willing to give a little bit here and there. And the question is, bottom line, is Pakistan the right negotiator for this? And if they are, what's the end game for Pakistan? What are they saying? What are the diplomats in Pakistan saying about, here's our perfect scenario, this is where we'd like to get?
Well, their perfect scenario is an indefinite ceasefire and talks continuing for as long as necessary till both sides just sort of back off. They don't want a shooting war. They will be content with this running as long as. Does anyone in this group remember how long the negotiations with the Vietnamese continued, or how long
for years,
or how long the negotiations continued with the Soviets and the Afghan government for the Geneva Accords about the Soviet withdrawal? I mean, they're quite happy to host something like that for a very long time, because it keeps them getting good attention rather than bad attention. Every day, the international media is discussing how Pakistan is facilitating two very difficult protagonists negotiate, rather than discussing Bin Laden having been there, or Pakistan having been behind the Mumbai attacks in India, or any such thing. So from their point of view, that's good enough. But of course, at some point, they will have to develop an end game. And my understanding is no one at this point has an end game.
What's it like where you are in Abu Dhabi? What are people that you associate with, who I assume are other diplomats and business people and so on? What's the chatter in Abu Dhabi?
Well, the biggest issue in not only Abu Dhabi, but all Gulf countries is the Iranian attacks on them, which took some of them by surprise. And basically, they feel attacked and they don't want any deal or agreement that does not take into account Iran's, shall we say, malign intent towards some of them. Look, there are three islands of the UAE that are occupied by the Iranians since the days of the Shah. They would like those to be discussed as well in any future long-term settlement involving the Iranian regime. The Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis have always complained about Iran interfering in their internal politics and in their internal affairs. So everybody has concerns that are important to them.
I want to ask you about the leverage that any of the Gulf states might have on Iran, but first we have to step away for just a second for our sponsor. Okay, we're back. Ambassador Haqqani, I want to ask you about the kind of leverage that the Gulf states can apply on Iran, or for that matter, the United States, to end this war. Do they have any power to do that?
Well, if you're talking about absolute hard power, perhaps not. But they certainly have tremendous influence. The economic influence of the Gulf states over the United States and over many other countries is significant. And we saw even in this war that when they came under attack, everyone from the Trump administration to Ukraine to President Macron of France, everybody rushed to say, we are, even the South Koreans, everybody said, okay, you guys need more anti-missile interceptors. We'll provide them. We'll be there to protect you. But other than that, very frankly, in a shooting war, right now, I don't think that the Gulf states want to get involved. They don't. But B, they are hoping that their economic leverage and the fact that they are critical to the global economy because of their very important resource, oil, everybody has an interest in their protection. So India, China, the United States, and Europe, everybody, and Japan and Korea have an interest in their security.
Does this mean, to take this out of Diplo speak and into concrete terms, does this mean they have or could have Trump backed into a corner, that they have the power to demand that Trump make a settlement and stop the war, open up the strait, and so on?
They could. Although at the moment, I think that the likelihood that they would want Trump to at least ensure that there are guarantees for their security moving forward, that there is no deal which is just a Trump deal, which is only which only puts Trump first or America first without paying attention to the interests of every other party that is affected by Iran, that they would be they would try and stop that rather than encourage a deal at any price or deal at any cost.
Does this mean they would want Iran disarmed?
They would certainly want severe restrictions on Iran's ability to attack any of them, and that includes especially the missile program.
Wow, that's a big, big ask.
It is.
So one of the bewildering aspects of all this is nobody's really clear who's in charge in Iran right now. You know, the report, there seems to be the IRGC seems to have to be the power center at the moment. But I'm wondering about the state of intelligence, about real-time intelligence about who's running Iran right now. Now, Pakistan has a notoriously powerful intelligence service, the ISI. By the way, is Munir, the field marshal, is he in charge of the ISI?
Well, he is the chief of defense forces. He used to be director general of ISI at one point, but now he's the head of the whole shebang. So, yeah.
But do you have a sense that the ISI or has any insight into what's going on inside Iran right now?
Absolutely. I think they have better insight than those who are very far away and speculating. Look, let's be very honest. The assumption that, you know, like in the movies, you arrive on a different planet and you say, take me to the leader. And once we get to the leader, everything will be done. That assumption is wrong for a country like Iran. Iran thinks of itself as a civilizational state, not as a normal 200-year-old, 250-year-old country that has nothing to show for it beyond that. There are houses in Iran where people live and very proudly say, my family has been living in this very house for the last 900 years. That is something that is not easily understood by those who have no desire to understand history. I mean, Henry Ford used to say, history is bunk. All that matters is profit. Well, very frankly, if that's the attitude you're going to approach Iran with, you will not understand Iran. So, yes,
There is a chain of command in Iran. The supreme leader is in charge. The IRGC has taken over, which basically means that the elected civilian government is less powerful. That is something Pakistanis understand very well. That's most of their 78-year history. And look, everybody in the region, Pakistan as well as the Arab Gulf countries, everybody advised against this operation. The only cheerleader for it was Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. And there were assumptions on the Israeli side that there will be a revolution, another revolution in Iran. Iran is ready for it. We've seen that commentary in Israeli newspapers where they are criticizing head of Mossad for giving wrong assessments. Whatever happened, the fact remains there is somebody in charge in Iran. And if anything, instead of toppling the regime, bringing it down, basically, the system has consolidated, and the voices for diversity and the voices for opening up are going to be crushed. There may be individuals. Today, President Trump apparently tweeted about 8 people whose lives have been spared. There'll be some individuals like that, but there will be a lot of people who will probably, you know, lose their lives over the misassessments of the very people who misassessed Iraq's nuclear weapon program. And I think that the real thing that Americans need to start thinking about is that unless we actually have a culture in which people understand other cultures and other civilizations and other people's history and their relationships with one another, we will always keep making these mistakes. Vietnam was the same type of mistake. Iraq was the same type of mistake. Afghanistan, where we fought the Taliban and then negotiated with them to leave them back in charge, are all examples of the same. So Let us be realistic about it. Iran has a particular culture, and in that culture, no one turns on the country in a time when that country is
being attacked. I'm just wondering also a bit about the irony here of Pakistan being the country that's trying to broker a nuclear deal that restricts Iran's nuclear program. Pakistan is a nuclear power on its own. It acquired its nuclear capabilities in stealth without any international agreement. Where is Pakistan coming off to tell Iran that it should restrict its nuclear program?
Absolutely. And if I were Iranian, I would turn around and say that to them. But right now, the Iranians' real problem is the potential of being bombed to high heaven by Israel and the United States. So they'll turn to anybody who they think will help them get some time for them. And there is a version of events in which Pakistan is actually being helpful to Iran. By keeping this process of negotiations going. So it gives them time to take a breath. It gives them time to, to consolidate their political system. We must also remember Pakistan is very close to China. China has stakes here as well. China has been one of the big military backers of Iran. So in pure grand strategy terms, I think you and I could end up discussing this forever. But this was not a very well thought out war from the American point of view. And the assumption that, you know, something that required much more understanding of many more dimensions. And yes, you are right. I mean, there are many questions about Pakistan's role. But very frankly, President Trump thinks that Field Marshal Asim Munir is his favorite field marshal. Although I keep wondering how many field marshals has he known in his life.
But that makes me wonder. So essentially what you're saying is this war was, a mistake of magnitude that it's really hard to put any of the pieces back in place where there's going to be a real resolution other than a stalemate that goes on and on. But you're a diplomat, right? You're used to situations where it seems like there's no kind of resolution. If you were in the diplomat, this is a two-pronged question. If you were the diplomat in the room, is there some idea you would propose that would take this other than a stalemate, number one? And number two, has anything happened in the reporting on the negotiations that surprised you in terms of what Iran's response has been or the United States' response has been?
Well, I think that a more conventional American administration would have dealt with negotiations differently. They wouldn't have entered them without the preparation that was missing here. There was an assumption that we'll go with a set of proposals and that will be enough. Anybody who has negotiated with the Iranians knows that you get a history lecture the moment you start talking to the Iranians. You know, you can't buy pistachios in Iran without hearing the history of the pistachio seller. So that was definitely a huge mistake in terms of the negotiating strategy. But other than that, look, the U.S. demands are clear. But there should always be a difference.
Did you say the U.S. demands are clear?
That they were clear to start with. They've become muddled. Become muddled along the way. The problem is that demands and expectations are not the same thing. So you actually base your expectations on a realistic assessment of what you might get. And then you demand anything and everything you might want. Look, no one negotiates the end of their own regime. No one, ever. Regime change is not accomplished by air power alone. It's just not possible. So regime change was an unrealistic demand, but demands relating to nuclear program and curtailment of it are realistic and could have been framed in a much more reasonable manner. The Omanis who were helping negotiate before the war between the US and Iran on purely the nuclear question say that they were close to a deal. That my understanding is, would have been a deal about giving up the enriched uranium, except some quantity for civilian purposes, opening up sites for international inspections, and ending the pursuit of nuclear weapons.
And that would have been a deal that looked very much like the one that Obama and his
Jeff, you don't stop reminding
partners.
Us of that. But yes, that is true. That is
and Trump true. Wouldn't Trump wouldn't want anything that resembles something that Obama got.
Well, we have already in the United States the Obamacare, but we don't call it Obamacare anymore. So the same thing could happen with the JCPOA. We could now call it the Trump plan for protecting the world from Iranian nukes.
And give them a
Nobel
Prize.
Well, Pakistan proposed it. I mean, that's...
Remember, it all started, his fascination with Pakistan started with the very smart move on the part of Pakistan's current leaders, who have not been very smart in running the country in any other way. The economy is not doing well. The people are not happy. The elections, last elections, have been described as being a total fraud, etc., etc. But they were very smart in realizing that the way, you know, to Trump's heart is by praising him. And that's why they nominated him for the Nobel Prize, and they'll probably do it again. I wouldn't be surprised.
But not just praising him, like the Pakistani finance minister signs a deal with World Liberty Financial, the crypto firm founded by the Trump and Witkoff families. And
have you seen the Roosevelt Hotel deal, where the General Services Administration of the United States government is signing a deal with Pakistan, which owns the Roosevelt Hotel in Manhattan, which is a whole acre. A whole city block between 45th and 46th on Madison Avenue.
I'm shocked that there's corruption in this deal with the Trumps.
GSA. I mean, when has GSA signed hotel development deals in the past?
It's negotiated by Witkoff, according to the New York Times.
But here's my point. None of these are going to really... The problem is... Doing anything that is relatively long term in an administration that is itself relatively short term is fraught with risk. And so the Pakistanis have been clever. They did not do a deal with any of the companies of the Trump camp. They did it with the GSA. So the US government is kind of involved. Similarly, that was the memorandum of understanding. Similarly, on the crypto side also, nothing has actually happened. It's still memoranda of understanding and potential promises. But hey, with somebody who is quite happy with that, that's a very good way to win him over and become the key mediator, and that's what Pakistan has accomplished.
Well, we can only hope that all that grease results in a peace deal and somehow gets us all out of this.
Now, that would be asking for too much, Jeff. But let's see if it can at least make the ceasefire a little more permanent and some of the immediate issues, the security of the Gulf states, the security and openness of the Strait of Hormuz, and the threat from Iran's nuclear program. If those can somehow be limited in the short term, then we will buy time for a future American president who is willing to listen to people, think things through, and act not by govern not by Twitter but by actual policy. We may actually have some better future ahead.
So we may have to look for another administration. This could go on for another couple of years in this kind of stalemate. But the Strait of Hormuz has to be unlocked at some point, long before another administration comes in.
Absolutely.
I would think. Anyway, Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for your very valuable insights. You're really in the catbird seat to analyze all this for us. Thank you very much for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.